Today, the never-ending bail-in scandal. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering Finance and Property News with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, we're going to discuss the deposit bail-in situation once again. This is actually part three of a series, and I'm joined again by John Adams. Hello, John.
Hello, sir. How are you going today?
Very good. How are you?
Excellent.
So we've really put the cat among the pigeons, I think it's fair to say.
Yes, there are a few people who watched our part two and were quite shocked with what we exposed in our last episode.
So I think it's probably worth just recapping. So there is a part one, I'll put the link up above and in the comments below, which describes what bail-in is and why it came about. So it looks a bit at the international situation, it looks
That's
at
right.
New Zealand, it looks at examples overseas where deposits were grabbed as part of a banking restructure.
Yes. Right.
Part two, which was the one we did quite recently, looked then specifically at the terms and conditions that appears to be at least vague and perhaps even worse than vague, which allows potentially deposits to be grabbed, possibly. It's just very unclear.
Yes, yes. And the reason why we did part two was because I got some pushback after part one. So part one, we talked about the definition of conversion and write-off. And then an advisor to a senator in parliament said that we should be looking at another clause, section 11 CAB. And what we then obviously did in the last episode is we explored that particular section and I showed how the advisor didn't necessarily look at how that clause would actually operate with the standard terms and conditions with bank deposits. So we obviously went through that. And so obviously that got a bit of reaction, and we've got a few things to talk about today.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, I think, we're not doing this out of a sense of wanting to create disruption, but it's a quest for clarity, because we think this issue is really, really important. It has the potential to impact many people across Australia. And the question is all the time, is there something below the surface that effectively people are trying to avoid, or is it just very poor policy that's been badly worded, right? Because if it's badly worded policy, simple, Parliament, just put an amendment in and remove deposits off the table.
Yes.
If it's something else,
then tell the people.
We need to know.
That's right.
And by the way, it's just worth saying that in New Zealand, where they're absolutely explicit about deposits being in and on the table, as it were, right, the feedback from a number of people in New Zealand is they had no idea that actually that was the situation.
Yes. So, and in the last few days, I have gotten emails from New Zealand as well. And basically, they were saying that the media, even though the New Zealand Central Bank has been crystal clear about the position, the media has done basically a pretty poor job at communicating public information to New Zealand citizens about what's really going on.
And that's a worry, of course, because in New Zealand, the Reserve Bank over there has said individuals need to take accountability for the decisions they take as to where they put their money.
Exactly.
And they've even put a scorecard up
to
try and help people decide where to put their money.
Yes. So they've done all that and still the people don't know what's going on because the media won't tell their people what's happening. And obviously in this country, our media won't tell our people what's going on. And the question is, well, why is there systemic failure in the media? I mean, the Royal Commission's looking at systemic failure in the banks about bank practices. Well, maybe we need some sort of investigation to systemic failure in the media and who's really driving the agenda, in terms of the stories that are being communicated to the public.
Yeah, and I guess partly you could say, well, it's really complicated and because it's vague and not clear, it's hard to sort of navigate around. But actually, you know, it's not that hard once you start looking at it, is it?
No.
And that's the key point. Okay, so but we're going to sort of take the conversation a little bit further now.
Yes.
Because we've had yet more evidence come in.
Yes, yes. So there's a few things to communicate. There was a DFA subscriber watcher who got a little bit freaked out because of our part two. And basically her concern over what we said in the last episode has triggered a flurry of correspondence. And she's communicated back to us as to what she has done. So she has written to certain members of parliament. She's spoken to the treasurer's office, so Treasurer Frydenberg. But she also basically called one of the big four and basically said, can you actually explain your terms and conditions? So I actually understand what's going on because I have my life savings in your bank. Now, in the, you know, without mentioning which institution or the individual's name, the bank, when receiving this phone call, refused to explain the terms and conditions of their deposit account to their customer. And they said that if you want further clarity, you have to go to ASIC and to APRA. Now, you've got a background in banking. I've never worked in the bank, but I just find that to be quite peculiar that a business cannot tell a customer what their sort of contract is between them, as in the business, with the customer. And why would you have to go to ASIC or APRA to understand what contracts are between the bank and the customer?
Yeah, I think generally my point would be that the bank tries to avoid interpreting or explaining the terms and conditions. They sort of throw the 200 pages across the table and say, there you go, right? And they just assume that people never read it.
Right.
This isn't the first time that I've heard where they refuse to actually go into a conversation around a particular clause. So we shouldn't necessarily smell a rat. But it is weird that the banks themselves don't seem to want to talk about this.
Exactly. So I mean, you may be able to answer this question. So if this particular individual goes to ASIC and to APRA and says, I have a deposit account with one of the big four, this is their T's and C's, they can just change the contract at any second. Well, what is the regulator going to actually tell the customer?
Well, it's not the regulator's responsibility, right? The terms and conditions are actually the responsibility of the individual lender, right?
Right.
Who drafted them, the lawyer in the bank drafted them. So if I were ASIC or APRA and somebody came and asked me that question, I'd pass them back to the bank.
So basically now what we're probably going to see with this customer is a merry-go-round. Bank won't say anything. Go to the regulator. Regulator says, we can't talk about the specific contracts of a particular institution. Go back to the bank. And in that process, the customer gets no clarity.
I suspect that's what we'll find, but I could be wrong. You know, maybe there's a third way. Sure. But I thought it was also interesting that another communication channel that somebody suggested as this particular person was searching, right?
Yeah.
Was, well, perhaps you should write to the Royal Commission.
Yes. So this individual went to the Treasurer's office, so Treasurer Frydenberg, and spoke to one of the Treasurer's advisors. And rather than the Treasurer's office providing clarity in terms of how the law actually works and what is the government's position, the Treasurer's office said that this individual should write to the Royal Commission. Now, according to the letters patent of the Royal Commission, the Commissioner, Commissioner Hayne, has the ability to investigate any conduct, practices, behaviour or business activities by financial services entities that fall below community standards and expectations. So one could argue that the ability to change deposit T's and C's without any forewarning to customers would be below community expectations. I'm making a bit of a general subjective judgment, but I think this is where the Australian Wood people say, well, if you're going to change the rules of the game on me, you can't just do it without telling me. You've got to actually give me some forewarning so I can actually understand what the change will be. Do I accept them? Do I want to move my money, etc.? So I think it's reasonable for the Treasurer's office to have said, okay, this falls within the terms of reference of the Royal Commission, write to the Commissioner. But obviously the Commissioner has a full plate of issues that they're pursuing. So this, I think, would be a new issue for the Royal Commission to potentially examine in terms of the deposit account terms and conditions and whether they have the resources and the scope and the time to add this new issue on there. That is obviously a question mark. So if the Royal Commission doesn't have the time and it's not looked at by the Commissioner, again, we're going to have another sort of merry-go-round. Politician saying, Royal Commissioner, go to the Royal Commission. Royal Commission says, we don't have enough time, resources or scope to look at this new issue, go back to Parliament. And again, no clarity on the law.
But it occurs to me that perhaps other people may also choose to approach the Commission as well, right? Because I guess if a lot of people all say, hey, we're worried about this particular issue.
Yes.
There's an open door there from the Treasurer's Department to actually escalate it. So, another strategy possibly worth thinking about.
So Martin, can you tell me, from where we are now in October, how much time does the Royal Commission have before it's supposed to wind up?
I think it's February, unless it's extended.
So, okay, so there's still at least a good 4 or 5 months. Mm.
Yeah, and there are some hearings specifically on policy related issues.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, this could be. So the first part was on case studies. So they looked at particular things that the banks brought to the commission.
Yes.
But there are some broader policy issues. So I would have thought that this is the sort of thing that could potentially be caught with the embrace of some of the policy discussion.
Interesting. Okay, so basically, to any of you watching the show, you've heard it from Martin. We've got 5 months, 4 or 5 months until the Royal Commission winds up, unless it's extended. And therefore, if you guys want this issue clarified, write to the Royal Commission, get other people to write to the Royal Commission, and then let's see if the Commissioner is willing to entertain this subject.
And I think it's worth making, there are two points, right? The first point is the specific issue around deposit bail-in. Right?
Yes.
And the second issue is the more general point about the terms and conditions that seem to have within them, embedded in the 200 pages.
Yes.
The sorts of clauses that basically allows a bank to drive coach and horses through on any basis they want to.
Yes.
For any purpose.
Indeed.
Right? And actually, I've done a bit more digging around, and it's not just in the deposit wording.
Okay.
If you look at mortgage documents, for example.
Yes.
There are similar things there too. So this is a behavioural trait within the way that the banks operate.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So that sort of covers that issue. So the other sort of interesting thing that I thought we should cover was an individual sent me a letter from Senator Jane Hume. Now, Senator Jane Hume is a Liberal senator from Victoria. She's the chair of the Senate Economics Committee. She was the chair of the inquiry that looked into this legislation that passed Parliament in February, and she has been a big advocate of this legislation. There was some concern. So obviously there were certain people around the country listening to, for example, the CEC. They were concerned about the passage of the legislation and how the legislation was passed. They wrote to Senator Hume. Senator Hume wrote back with a one-page letter. I will show the sort of the letter on the screen to show that this came from the senator's office. But there was a sentence in there that I was quite shocked with, that I thought would be important that we communicate to the viewers about what the senator actually said. So the senator told this constituent.
And we should say we have the permission of the constituent to quote this particular piece, right?
Yes. We won't mention the constituent's name, but the constituent said that they were happy for us to show the letter without their name, but also to quote the letter.
Yep.
So the senator said that, quote, "I can assure you that this bill does not constitute what some are referring to as bail-in legislation." Now, that sentence, to me, is completely false and misleading, because what we know from the G20 statements, we know from, as we covered in episode one, about what the RBA, former RBA governor, said about the need for a bail-in framework. Even in the Senate Economics Committee report, they talked about the ability to bail in hybrid securities, but also the fact that the legislation talks about conversion and write-off, that in and of itself says that bail-in was in the legislation, and that was the intent. Now, had she said, "I can assure you this bill does not constitute the bail-in of deposits," that is one thing. But when she said blanket, "This has nothing to do with bail-in," I mean, I don't understand how a senator could issue a letter like that.
And it's worth saying that she is not without financial services experience.
No. I think so, she is the type of person that, you know, when we talked about in the last episode of whether there's a conspiracy or a cock-up, well, she has a long line in her career of working for banks, whether it's Deutsche Bank or the Rothschilds Australia Bank, or in terms of NAB. So again, you know, there are certain people who go into Parliament and people sort of, you know, question as to, well, why are they in Parliament? Are they there to represent certain interests, or are they there to actually serve the public? And it's not just about the financial services sector. I mean, whether it's the law profession or the accounting profession or the farmers sort of industry, etc. I mean, it is a constant sort of question as to, or even with the ALP and the unions. I mean, you know, are they there representing the public interest, or are they there representing a sectorial interest? And so obviously she comes from a particular sector, and she has been instrumental in getting this legislation through very quietly through the Senate, because she actually played a very key role in that. And then yet she's sent, issuing these letters to constituents saying this has nothing to do with bail-in, whether it's deposits or hybrid securities. So again, you know, the constituent obviously saw our part one, saw our part two, then sent me this letter and said, well, what's going on? And I said, well, it looks like that you've been misled by the senator.
So I think just before we close out today's session, there's one other thing we should probably address, and that is some people, small number, have suggested that we've been fear-mongering.
Yes.
So let's just explore that for a little bit, right? Because I don't think that's what we are doing at all. We are actually trying to be objective. We are trying to be balanced. But we are also, I think, pressing against an issue that is really a bit smelly.
Yes, yes. So there was one DFA listener who particularly after part two, you know, and I don't know their real name, but their name on YouTube is Dave B. They said a couple of things. They said, you know, that as you and I, you are not looking at related laws and are fear-mongering based on a narrow view of one piece of legislation. No legislation works in isolation. So this is what the criticism of us. Now, so we don't have time to go through the entire bill or the entire act, but part one, we talked about the definition of conversion and write-off, which was a part of Section 31. Another part of Section 1 was this, what we described as Section 11 CAB, but in reality is a subsection because we were quoting only the first part of Section CAB. The second part of CAB, which we should actually bring up on the screen now, basically says that when you're looking at the conversion of instrument despite other laws, the instrument may be converted in accordance with the terms of the instrument despite any Australian law or any foreign law or a part of a foreign country other than a specified law or the constitution of any entities or any contract or arrangement with the relevant party or any listing rules or operational rules of a financial market or any operating rules of the clearing and settlement facility. So subsection 11 CAB 2 says that the ability to bail in, I'm not a lawyer, you're not a lawyer, but the way I read it is that nothing can interfere with this power. So this can happen despite any other law. So when this Dave B said that no law works in isolation, well, guess what? This law works in isolation.
Yeah, this looks like the peak, right? So yes. The other stuff, but effectively this will override it.
100%, yeah. 100%. And so when we got criticism on YouTube by Dave B, he didn't realise by looking at subsection 11 CAB 2 that actually, in fact, the way they wrote the law was, no, there is nothing that would impede the ability to convert or write off.
Yep. Okay, well, that's, I think, enough on this today, but let's just recap on two points, right? We're saying, one, it's very unclear as to what the full situation is.
Yeah.
Right? It could be just a mess up, in which case it needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
Or it could be something a little more sinister, which is that it's part of the overall bail-in powers that have been used elsewhere around the world or have been wired into the legislation around the world.
Yeah.
We want to know. We want to know the truth, and that's all we're after. We want to know what the truth is.
Yes, yes. And you know, when you look at the movie, I think it's called A Few Good Men, and they said you can't handle the truth. Well, I think Martin North and John Adams can handle the truth. So Prime Minister, Treasurer, if you're listening, tell us the truth. We want it.
And not just us, but I think the Australian public needs it too.
Yes, absolutely.
John, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
So there you have it. A little more on bail-in today. I suspect we're going to revisit this. If you have other thoughts and observations, please do add them to the posts and your comments and questions, and we'll try and deal with them. And thank you very much for watching, and come and check back next time. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. See you next time.